Hey everyone, it's Reese Tisdale. This is Future Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. So let Bluefield Research be your guide to making better decisions or just to be better informed. Today, it's all about money. That is, how exposed are utilities, their budgets, and spending to a recession, which seems like we're in it now. So we might as well start talking through it in a little bit more detail. So today, I'm joined by Erin Bonnie Casey, Research Director of Bluefield. Some of you heard from her before. I think she's going to add some more insights. Erin, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me on today. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Yeah, this is something we've been talking about, one through a number of presentations, webinars, and client meetings about what's the impact of COVID or recession. It seems like it's all running together. So let's see if we can cut to the chase. Simply speaking, let's see if we can simplify it a bit. Where do utilities get their money?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the baseline question. So I guess, first of all, let's just specify that we're talking about public utilities, which serve about 85% of the total market. Private for-profit utilities are a little bit different, and we'll leave that to another discussion. But for public utilities, they're basically trying to get enough money to cover their expenses. And those expenses fall under two buckets, short-term operating expenses and long-term capital expenses.
So what you're getting at, and I'm projecting a little bit, but I guess you're talking about OPEX and CAPEX, and the funding sources differ. So how do they differ?
Yeah, so they look really different. So operating expenses are by and large funded through operating revenue. And that primarily comes from fees for service. So fees for drinking water, for wastewater, and in some cases for stormwater service fees. And when we look at utility budgets, these types of fees for service provide about 90-95% of the operating budget. There's also some utilities that use other tax revenues to fund their water budgets. So Atlanta is a good example of that. They have a sales tax that goes directly to their Department of Watershed Management, which enables them to generate revenue for the utility and keeps the fee for service relatively low. An interesting thing to note about Atlanta is that they're able to do that in part because their water utility is a department within the city. In a city like Boston, for example, where I am, that type of funding is much more difficult, and it actually doesn't happen in Boston because the water and sewer utility is a separate entity from the city. So it's important to understand that the way that the utility is structured, because that influences the financing mechanisms available to it. In most cases, in most years, the operating revenue, primarily from those fees for service, covers the operating costs, and that's because that's how rates are set. The water and sewer services sold are intended to cover the cost of supplying those services.
But to cut you off there for a sec, is this really what we're talking about when everybody talks about affordability, is really this, because it's tied to the rates, right?
Yeah, exactly. When you get a bill as a resident or as a business owner, that's what you're talking about. It's a fee for service. Usually it's based on the amount of water that you use, which is used to calculate both your water and your sewer bill. And that contributes directly to that operating budget.
And then I guess what you're probably going to get into is we talk about CapEx, and that is for all the assets that are underground that no one really thinks about, I suppose.
Yeah. So on the CapEx side, most of those longer term investments are funded through debt, and the mechanisms that available to fund that debt are really different depending on the size of the utility. So for large utilities, the ability to issue bonds provides a lot of the funding for CapEx. Loans are another way that utilities are able to fund CapEx. Commercial loans are one possibility, but again, usually large utilities are able to access lower interest rates. And then there are also loans offered through government programs. So for smaller utilities in particular, the state revolving funds and the USDA Water and Waste Loan and Grant Program offer low interest loans and grants to fund capital improvement projects. The WIFIA program is another example of a federal program that offers low interest loans, but it primarily goes to large projects, which end up being associated with large utilities typically. And other sources of operating revenues include the sale of other byproducts like biosolids or bulk water sales or even services to other utilities. But those alternative sources of revenue, you could even think of them as cost mitigation. They make up a really small percentage of operating budgets overall.
Yeah, I know we've talked about that, the cost mitigation. I mean, when it comes to things like biosolids, they have to put that somewhere, right? Either it goes to a landfill or somewhere else. And I know We have a report coming out we've been working on a while on biosolids and sort of different business strategies and models that utilities are using to dispose of the waste, whether it be paying someone to take it to a landfill or using it for other agricultural uses and also just turning in fertilizer, DC Waters, Bloom. But there are a number of others that we've looked at. That's pretty interesting. But like you said, it's pretty small. And I think the WIFIA program, everybody gets excited about. I've been one to kind of knock it a bit. There are a number of reasons for that. One, it seems like monument building to me. But for SRF, I think you raised that as a source of funding. Seems pretty stable. So let's talk about that for 2 seconds. We just looked at you and the team went through about 11,000 plus loan and grant requests. What's the story with SRF? And should we be concerned about that given the state of the economy and what the federal government's doing right now?
Yeah, exactly. So that 11,000 projects requesting funding this year is a great reference point to give you a sense of the scale of that program. So when we went through that data, we found that those projects were requesting about $85 billion in funding. And this year, about $18 billion of that were selected to actually receive funding through loans and grants. That includes federal dollars that support those programs, as well as state matching dollars. And what we've seen in the past when we talk about recessions and SRF funding is that it's fairly stable. In fact, in the last recession, the Great Recession, I guess we're calling it now, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or the ARRA program, provided stimulus funding to the water sector directly through those SRF programs. So there could potentially be a bump in the SRF programs in the next couple of years if the federal government passes another similar stimulus package to alleviate the impacts of the current recession. There are some questions about how much of that funding is actually additive to the sector and how much of it displaced other sources of funding, like some of those commercial loans or bonds that we were talking about previously. Because capital is going to be so cheap in a recession scenario, it's potentially a good opportunity for utilities to access that cheap capital and fund CapEx projects. The potential downsides in a recession, state budgets are definitely going to be under strain, so they potentially aren't going to be able to contribute as much as they have historically to the SRF funds, so we could see some impact there. The other downside is, you know, we were talking about SRF funds being relatively robust in a recession, but those funds go to CapEx projects, and there aren't really similar mechanisms for funding OpEx. So the question is, how are utilities going to fund those OpEx budgets when they're under intense strain? One option is to look at FEMA disaster relief funding or at HUD's community development block grants. But given the anticipated scale of impact on water utility revenues, it's not at all clear whether those programs are going to be able to provide the needed support to bolster those operating revenues.
So what about the revenue recovery? Correct me if I'm wrong, maybe you know this. Either, I don't know if it's at the state level or even the federal level or Congress, should I say, that utilities are not going to be able to recover any revenues that were lost because of demand decline. So for instance, back to the city of Boston, everybody's working in the city, water demand is pretty stable, but elevated from where it is today because now everybody's working from home out in the suburbs. But the utilities aren't going to be able to recover that revenue, are they?
No. And I mean, I think you have to think about this on a utility by utility basis. So Boston's a great example because they have a big commercial sector that's right now shut down. Downtown's really quiet. And so they've actually seen their water use go down by about 20%, which means that the amount they're able to bill is similarly going to decline around 20%. But when you look at the suburbs immediately surrounding Boston, with everyone working from home, their water usage has actually gone up around 20%. And so they're able to bill more. Now, the question when you get into a recession starts to be your consumer's ability to pay. Because we know, you know, the unemployment levels being what they are, consumers are going to have to start cutting back on their bills. And a lot of water utilities have started saying that they're going to suspend shutoffs for non-payment of bills in light of the public health crisis, which means even if they're billing more to their residential customers, they might be taking in less revenue as those customers just aren't able to pay those bills.
It'll be interesting. I mean, we had a research call this morning with the whole team, and one of the things we're talking about was Springfield. Not to be so provincial talking about Boston, Massachusetts, sorry. I'm not from here, just for the record. Springfield, they were raising, there's a report that they're going to raise their rates 9.5%. So there's this interesting balance that utilities such as Springfield, who is certainly going to be hit by the recession, but they need to cover their costs, so they raise rates. So there's a vicious cycle that they're getting caught in. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when utilities, especially public utilities, when they set their rates, they're really doing a calculation about recovering their costs and the cost that they need to maintain safe drinking water and wastewater networks and services. So I think you can be sympathetic to the pressure that people are under and their inability to pay their bills. But from a utility perspective, they still need to generate that revenue. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that water utilities, even when the demand for water and sewer services goes down because things are shuttered and things are slowing down, their costs don't go down at the same rate. And so they still need to figure out a way to fund the ongoing maintenance for those systems.
Yeah, the assets are in the ground. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. I hate to be the pessimist. It could get ugly for a lot of utilities in there. What ends up happening, whether it be future M&A, because utilities can't cover cost or meet their operating requirements to their stakeholders, or will they have to look elsewhere for funding? And look, like you said, 11,000 applications for clean and drinking water SRF fund requests. I mean, $85 billion. Last year, I think, did we have our number at, was it $65, $70 billion? So the number's gone up, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, pretty much it goes up every year because essentially what happens is those projects that apply for the funding and then don't get it in that fiscal year, they can stay on the project priority list for those SRF programs. So you end up seeing this growing backlog of projects. And if they aren't able to get funds through the SRF program, are they going to have to go somewhere and find more expensive sources of capital to fund those programs?
Yeah, and we've also seen in the analysis, it varies widely by state. Some states are more proactive or, I don't know, supportive of bringing in applications. I mean, the federal government is basically saying, hey, you have access to these funds. If you match, you can have them, or those that have requested for the funds. And some of these are guaranteed loans, meaning they don't have to be paid back. So it'll be interesting the next cycle, once this plays out, how proactive states will be pushing that further. They're still going to have to come up with some money. In fact, as I see Arizona, see the COVID numbers in the news early this morning, it makes me think of last year or in the past couple of years that they've been a state that hasn't fully leveraged the SRF program, but they've made some strides, at least the last cycle, to do so, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So to what you're referring to before, the federal government allocates a certain amount of dollars to the state administered state revolving funds. In order to get your full allocation, you have to match 20%. Most states do that because you're leaving federal dollars on the table. There are a few states that when their budgets come under pressure, they don't make that 20% match. And in that case, they don't get their full allocation. Other states, the other way that the individual states differ is one, their ability to kind of communicate with their utilities about the funds that are available. So there are a few states, Arizona being one of them, that actually last year they were struggling and not getting enough applications. They actually did a marketing push to try and get utilities to be aware of the fact that there are these state revolving fund dollars available to them. And they saw a big increase in applications this year. So I think when we see that and we see underutilized SRF funds, we're always thinking, well, we know that the demand for dollars is there. We know that there are investments that need to be made. So what's going on there? And I think Arizona addressed that kind of head on. And the other option is we talk about a state like Ohio. They actually have committed that anyone who applies and is eligible to receive state revolving fund loans, they issue bonds in order to fund all of those loans. And so they supplement the money that comes from the federal government with bond issuance, which means their program is much bigger relative to the size of the state than some of the other programs. I think than any of the other programs, actually.
Yeah, I mean, money couldn't be cheaper these days, quite honestly, which is, I think, at least we internally and the industry as a whole, now is as good a time as any to pour money into infrastructure. While it may not be happening in Washington, and there are a lot of shortcomings of the discussions there, this is a big opportunity because any CapEx investments go well beyond the current recession, whether the recession is 1, 2, 3, even 5 years. Water assets last a long time. Let's talk about SRF for 2 seconds. Well, I think we went beyond that. I think the one last thing I would add, which is interesting looking at the SRF projects, there's 11,000 that I referred to, is we've also been doing some really interesting data mining and looking through the individual projects. It allows us to scour the projects like, hey, how much is going to PFAS remediation, or how much is going to wastewater reuse, or how much is going to stormwater? A lot of different cuts that we've made of that data. So that's interesting. So stepping back a little bit, looking at the tea leaves, we're now in July. So when it comes to state budgets and capital improvement plans, what are we seeing at Bluefield?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing our annual deep dive into utility capital improvement plans to see how their projected or planned spend over the next year has changed in their most recent publication of those capital improvement plans. You know, last year when we looked at this, we saw that it was up 2%. And that was really consistent with what we saw in terms of growth in the market, that they had increased the amount that they're planning on spending. I think this year we're going to see some declines in the amount that they're planning on spending. And we're going to see some of those larger scale capital improvement projects that can be pushed back will be, in order to refocus on some of these critical things and close that gap in funding.
Yeah, the CIPs are interesting in the sense of how proactive will they be in cutting them now? How much information do the utilities have about what their needs are going to be? Or do they stick with it and just not spend it? The states have to balance their budgets, but for utilities, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because that's always been one of the big questions that we get from clients when we present all of the data and we break it out. It feels like 8 ways from Sunday. How much will be deferred if a project goes from 2021 to 2022? All right, slides over, but the project's still happening. It's just a matter of the timing. Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens there. Any idea? I mean, we typically look at 100 plus of the larger utilities. How many do we have a sense we're going to be going through over the next month or so?
So we're prioritizing the ones whose fiscal year started at the start of July. The thought being that they're going to be most responsive to what happened during the last quarter. And that is 30 to 40 of those top 100 utilities put out a new capital improvement plan in July. So those are the first set that we're going to be focusing on.
Okay. And then what about on OPEX? Do we do anything on OPEX? Do we just sort of have to ride this one out and see where things fall?
So we're also going to be looking at operating budgets for utilities. We have been over the last few months, and we will continue over the next few to see how those are impacted. I think states, or utilities, I should say, are going to be relying on their reserves, if they have any, in the near term. And then the longer this goes, the more impact we're going to see on operating expenses.
And I know you, from the outset of this conversation, when you mentioned, you know, private utilities versus publics, well, you know, also their rate decisions are managed differently. The IOUs have to go through the regulatory commissions. They have to get approved going through their rate cases. So there's at least a mechanism on how that happens. Well, it's a presidential year. There are congressional elections. Looking at the various cities for utilities, I mean, at a municipal level, for those municipally owned utilities, the rate structures can be very politically driven, and when they're decided and at what levels, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see that the rate increases will depend on when the mayor gets elected, or when the mayor's up for re-election, or the city council. I mean, it varies by city how those rates are set and who oversees it, but there isn't a standardized way or a specific body that's in charge of oversight for those rates. The idea is that they're government agencies, they're not for profit, they're not charging exorbitant fees, they're just trying to cover costs. But for politicians, we definitely see them saying, well, we're going to keep rates flat this year because it's an election year. Usually when that happens, we just see a spike. Instead of seeing 2 years of 5% increases, we see 0 and then 10. It makes the rate increases lumpy, but ultimately the utilities need that money to continue operating.
Yeah, it's a holy mess. Looking at estimates, I was looking at some from Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. They're showing state budget shortfalls, if that's a proxy, of $615 billion from 2020 to 2022. And that's pretty significant when states as a whole, and every state's a little bit different. For rainy day funds, I think the cumulative total that they've estimated is about $75 billion, which means there's like a $440 billion shortfall. Where's that money going to come from? So to your point about state revolving funds and matching funds and just other loans and grants and infrastructure development, there's going to be a real crunch. The OPEX side for utilities is a whole nother matter. People have changed locations or working from home. So maybe there's downside. You know, the water sector is pretty mature, I think, as we all know, and has been pretty stable and steady. But there's all this disruption that's happening. And quite honestly, the problems don't go away. The problems that we had 6 months ago, whether it be emerging contaminants, whether it be PFAS, whether it just be aging infrastructure. Water mains are still breaking. I think I mentioned either on a podcast or a webcast that we're doing that I think the first week of this working from home, that was 3-4 months ago, we had a water main break on our street. There was no water and it was like because of a valve had broken. So what scares me is that the next step will be the cutbacks. And that's going to be states like New Jersey, who I think we saw recently, they were either delaying, deferring, foregoing their lead service remediation program that they were working on. They've had lead issues in the past and they were going to address it. Another one was New Hampshire has said, hey, we're not going to monitor for algae blooms. So it's basically like you're on your own, go swimming. You know, just last week or 2 weeks ago, I did hear on the radio that in the Charles River in Boston that they said, you know, don't let your dogs go into the river. But these are require monitoring. And like anything else, if you don't know the size of the problem, then you do need to monitor, test, figure out where it is, and then you can address it. These are just ongoing problems. Some could be OPEX related, could be CAPEX. So in any case, we could talk about that all day long. But so Aaron, we do have a webcast for clients next week. I think maybe even by the time this release, it'll be out. I'm not sure. But that webcast addressing contaminants of emerging concern in today's water market, which I think you're going to be on that, correct?
Yep, that's right. I'll be there. We're going to be talking about some of these issues related to advanced treatment, PFAS in particular, and basically how do those programs get funded? Do they get funded? What does the current market environment mean for advanced treatment and addressing emerging contaminants?
All right. Well, there's a lot going on. I know we're also talking about revised forecasts. We took a quick swing a couple months ago, but now we're getting more data and that's evolving. So we're trying to help clients out there. But Aaron, as always, thanks for stepping up. Be well, be safe, be kind, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks, Aaron. All right, this podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research, which is advancing water strategies and decisions globally. You can always learn more at bluefieldresearch.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast, The Future of Water. It's pretty new, so get out there, get on it. And if you have any questions or ideas for topics that you're interested in, feel free to reach out to us at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. All right, take care. Talk soon.